This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, 3 days on from the UK Prime Minister Theresa May's announcement that a snap general election will be held in June and battle lines are being drawn. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this rather unusual election is now being dubbed the Brexit election, and we'll be bringing you an update on the latest twists and turns and this morning's speech by opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. A report this week from Harvard University details a child protection emergency, with widespread reports of the commercial sexual exploitation of migrant children across camps and cities in Greece. But how have the mechanisms to support the most vulnerable in society failed to protect the thousands of children seeking refuge? The US National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster met with Pakistan's Prime Minister and Army Chief this week on the importance of confronting terrorism. But we'll be taking a closer look at the alleged role of the Pakistan Secret Service in aiding and abetting terrorism in South Asia. And animal lovers can be a strange bunch, but how far would you go to revive the life of a pigeon that suddenly dropped dead in a busy shopping centre? All that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus. It's 3 days now since the UK Prime Minister, Theresa May, made the shock announcement that she intends to hold a snap general election on the 8th of June. And with such a short window until voters take to the polls, political parties are wasting little time in taking their message to the streets. As the dust begins to settle on the PM's announcement, battle lines are already being drawn, and those battle lines are largely centering around the issue of Europe. Indeed, many have now dubbed this the Brexit election. For more on the twists and turns of this most unusual of general elections, Jack Foster has this report.
It was the day on which Edward the Confessor, back in 1042, ascended to the throne, becoming one of the last Anglo-Saxon kings of England, just a couple of hundred years after the Vikings, on the same day, first set foot on British soil in 793. It's also the date on which George Orwell's seminal novel 1984 was published, back in 1949. Yes, you could argue that June the 8th is something of a red-letter day in history. That said, it's also Kanye West's birthday, so swings and roundabouts. For now, though, in the United Kingdom, at least, June the 8th is synonymous with only one thing: a snap general election, and one that's being touted as an election on just one single issue: Brexit.
Let us put forward our plans for Brexit and our alternative programmes for government, and then let the people decide. Every vote for the Conservatives will make it harder for opposition politicians who want to stop me from getting the job done. Every vote for the Conservatives will make me stronger when I negotiate for Britain with the Prime Ministers, Presidents and Chancellors of the European Union.
The UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking there on Monday as she announced her intention to hold a snap general election on Thursday, June the 8th. Now, early polling paints a very comfortable picture for the governing Conservative Party, and that would certainly go a long way towards explaining Theresa May's enthusiasm for this election. Polling from Strathclyde University, which brings together an average poll of polls, so not insignificant, puts the Conservative Party on a healthy lead of 43%, up 6 on their 2015 general election win. And the opposition Labour Party are down 3 at 27%. With just over a month to go, the possibility of a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn looks pretty unlikely. The party has a mountain to climb, already 94 seats short of a majority in the House of Commons, and with internal division plain for all to see as the right and left of the party remain in an ongoing political tug of war over the socialist leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn faces an unusual situation for a political leader in the UK, in that he's deeply unpopular amongst his own members of parliament, but simultaneously hugely popular amongst party members throughout the country. Nevertheless, many inside and outside of the Labour Party have already written off any prospect of an election win in June. And it was that point that Jeremy Corbyn sought to tackle head-on during a speech this morning in London, which, in effect, launched his campaign for June the 8th.
Much of the media and the establishment are saying this election is a foregone conclusion. They think there are rules in politics which, if you don't follow by doffing your cap to the powerful people, accepting that things can't really change, then you can't win. But of course, they do not want us to win, because when we win, it is the people, not the powerful, who win. There are people in the audience that are wearing badges of Keir Hardie. He was vilified beyond belief when he was elected as the first ever Labour MP. They said, how can a working man go to Parliament and represent people? Anyone who stands up to create a better, fairer, more decent society gets vilified. Our party gets vilified. But I tell you what, we're bigger than we've ever been, we're stronger than we've ever been, and we're more determined than we've ever been.
UK opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking in London this morning to supporters and journalists, launching his campaign for June's snap general election. Now, the elephant in the room at Corbyn's speech was, of course, Brexit. His support base is very keen on his redistributive economic agenda and his opposition to the Tories, but in this, the Brexit election, Corbyn won't be capitalising on the overwhelming anti-Brexit sentiment in his party and in the country at large, a point he was questioned on following his speech.
We've set out our lines on negotiation. Primarily, it is about gaining and retaining tariff-free access to the European market. We haven't threatened to turn Britain into an offshore tax haven on the shores of Europe to undermine every European economy. We've instead said we want to work with them to have an agreed process by which we continue to trade with Europe. Because walking away and trading under World Trade Organization conditions will mean that manufacturing industry in this country would be severely damaged. So I have reached out to socialist colleagues all across Europe ever since I became the leader of the party, and I invited them all to come to London in February for a discussion about our approach and what relationships we want with them in the future. And those lines of negotiation will be the ones that we as a Labour government will negotiate with Europe on. We want to work with Europe. We accept the result of the referendum, but there still has to be an economic relationship with Europe. And we're not going to tear up the workers' rights agenda, the environmental protection agenda, or any human rights agenda.
UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking in London this morning. So, if this election is the Brexit election, as many have now dubbed it, how do anti-Brexit voters approach the ballot box in June? Well, in Scotland, that's fairly easy. The Scottish National Party are vehemently opposed to Brexit and hold the vast majority of seats north of the border. But in the rest of the UK, things aren't as simple. The Liberal Democrats would be the natural choice to oppose Brexit, but they're currently in fourth place overall and show no signs of making major gains. Sure, they're up 2% from their 2015 showing, but that won't be enough to make any real impact on Brexit negotiations, let alone put a stop to the process, as they've already stated they want to do. It's with that in mind that Gina Miller, the woman behind the successful High Court challenge, which required the UK Parliament to vote on the triggering of Article 50, now plans to launch a tactical voting campaign in opposition to a so-called hard Brexit. A crowdfunding page was set up just after Theresa May's announcement on Monday, which has already raised around 120,000 of its 135,000 goal. The campaign, which officially launches next week, says it will, quote, use the money to back candidates who pledge to support a full and free vote on the Brexit deal. And so, with 48 days to go now till Brits take to the polls, the campaigns are already out of their starting blocks. Currently, it looks like a Conservative majority and a disappointing result for Labour. But, well, if a week is a long time in politics, then 7 weeks is an eternity. Perhaps that sentiment was summed up best with Jeremy Corbyn's closing remark following his speech this morning.
In 2015, almost exactly 2 years ago, I was given 200-1 as an outside chance.
This is Jack Foster for World in Focus.
And Jack Foster joins me now in the studio to discuss this a bit further. Jack, given how far behind in the polls Jeremy Corbyn's party currently sits, just how significant could this speech ever have been?
Well, I mean, that depends on your view of Jeremy Corbyn, of course. I think, as you say, he is very far behind in the polls. 6 weeks is a long time in politics, who can say? As he pointed out during the speech, he was, I think, 200-1 to become leader of his own party. And then, of course, he won that by a landslide back in 2015. And then when his parliamentary party tried to take him on and remove him, he then won again and increased his share of the membership vote. So Jeremy Corbyn does have form of winning votes against the odds when no one thinks he's going to at the outset. I think a general election, though, could be a slightly different story, and time will tell on that.
And as you pointed out in that report, polling shows the Conservatives well ahead. Is there any conceivable reality in which Theresa May might see Jeremy Corbyn as a threat?
I think, again, going back to what I was saying there about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn has surprised people before with wins, albeit within his own party, there is a possibility that she might not be, at least quietly and in private, not underestimating Jeremy Corbyn. Certainly her decision not to take part in televised debates suggests that she may see him as more of a threat than she's letting on. Theresa May is a politician, and politicians make decisions like that based on tactics on whether or not they think it will be beneficial or otherwise for them. Now, if Theresa May genuinely believed what she projects outwardly, which is that Jeremy Corbyn is a shambles, he presents himself terribly, and that then surely she would think, well, a televised debate would be great news for her. She could only come out on top, and it would only expose further how awful Jeremy Corbyn is. If she's not agreeing to do that, and she seems very set on not taking part in televised debates, it suggests that perhaps in private, Theresa May thinks that Jeremy Corbyn may be a little more formidable than she's letting on.
And how solid a campaign does Corbyn's Labour Party have now, just 6 weeks out from this election?
Well, that's difficult to say. I mean, because there are two strands to this. On the one hand, there was the campaign rhetoric that we heard from Jeremy Corbyn today, which is very similar to that of his own leadership campaign within the party, very much about redistribution of wealth, more socialist policies, bringing down sort of big money, offshore tax havens, that kind of thing. But of course, this election, much as Jeremy Corbyn and much the Labour Party might like it to be, isn't going to be about those things. As we both know, this is going to be an election that is entirely about Brexit and about Europe. And the Tories are in a very good position to scoop up the pro-Brexit vote on that. And Labour could have been in a position to oppose Brexit, but of course Jeremy Corbyn doesn't. And weirdly, within the party, many of his own MPs do oppose it and want to oppose Brexit at this election, but they can't. So they're not going to really scoop up the anti-Brexit vote. So I think that may cancel out a lot of the good that that rhetoric about socialist policies might do as well.
Jack Foster, many thanks for that.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, a report this week from Harvard University details a child protection emergency, with widespread reports of the commercial sexual exploitation of migrant children across camps and cities in Greece. But how have the mechanisms to support the most vulnerable in society failed to protect the thousands of children seeking refuge? We'll have more on that in a few moments.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
When and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
By any means necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us. From mass incarceration...
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik. Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Still to come on today's programme, a report this week from Harvard University details a child protection emergency with widespread reports of the commercial sexual exploitation of migrant children across camps and cities in Greece. But how have the mechanisms to support the most vulnerable in society failed to protect the thousands of children seeking refuge? The US National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster met with Pakistan's Prime Minister and Army Chief this week on the importance of confronting terrorism. But we'll be taking a closer look at the alleged role of the Pakistani Secret Service in aiding and abetting terrorism in South Asia. And animal lovers can be a strange bunch, but how far would you go to revive the life of a pigeon that suddenly dropped dead in a busy shopping centre? A new report from Harvard University's Centre for Health and Human Rights has shed light on the horrific experiences of child refugees. The report details a, quote, growing epidemic of sexual exploitation and abuse of migrant children in Greece. But is this crisis one which will only be fully understood with the benefits of hindsight? Carolyn Scott has this report.
The report from Harvard University, entitled Emergency Within an Emergency, The Growing Epidemic of Sexual Exploitation and Abuse of Migrant Children in Greece, makes for a harrowing and incredibly uncomfortable read. After conducting research with informants, psychologists, doctors, government officials and lawyers in several Greek sites on the island of Lesbos and Chios and in the cities of Athens and Thessaloniki, the report highlights six major risk factors, those being an insufficient number of specialised facilities for children, risky living conditions inside camps, potentially hazardous and unsupervised commingling of migrant children with the adult migrant population, weak and insufficiently resourced child protection systems, a lack of coordination and cooperation among responsible actors, and an inefficient and radically inadequate relocation scheme. It's a wide-ranging report detailing a child protection emergency. In June 2015, 1 in 10 migrants was a child, but within 6 months, this figure had tripled to 1 in 3. The majority of recorded child migrants originate from three countries, with 27% coming from Syria, 27% coming from Afghanistan, and 24% coming from Pakistan. The remaining 22% come from Iraq, Bangladesh, Algeria, Morocco, Iran, Palestine, and several other countries. Though the actual figures of unaccompanied child migrants are likely to be considerably higher than those reported. Many unaccompanied children present themselves as adults or as accompanied during registration in order to avoid delaying their onward journey. Perhaps the most shocking elements of this study are the reports of the commercial sexual exploitation of children, apparently widespread in both rural and urban areas. Many children now stranded in Greece are following dangerous alternative methods to either simply survive or to pay people smugglers for their onward journeys. The report states, quote, given the very limited income-generating options available to them, children gravitate towards dangerous and illegal activities to pay smugglers, including theft, drug dealing and transactional sex, end quote. One camp worker told the researchers, quote, you don't have to see it, you know that it exists. As long as children walk around the city alone without protection, and given the current circumstances, they run the risk of being victimised at any moment. If you're close to them, they tell you that they have ways to find money and continue their journey. They never state clearly what these methods are, but they imply it, end quote. Professor Jacqueline Baba, Professor of Health and Human Rights at Harvard University, co-authored the report, and I spoke to her yesterday about the findings. Professor Baba, thank you very much for speaking to me today. Now, the report states that the number of children involved in this humanitarian crisis is comparable only to World War II. Is this, do you think, really something that is understood by the general public?
I don't think it is. I think we have a sense that there are people trying to cross borders, that there is a terrible war in Syria, and that, you know, people are not doing well in the camps in the region. But I don't think there's an adequate understanding of the extent of human misery, suffering and devastation, really, that we're witnessing at the moment. Not only as a result of the war in Syria, which, of course, has displaced more than half the population and has been going on for 6 years, and over 400,000, so nearly half a million people have lost their lives. But also there's an enormous humanitarian emergency going on in South Sudan, where millions are at risk, and every day hundreds of thousands of people at the moment are crossing the border into Uganda. So that is a crisis of immense proportions, triggered by sort of a civil war or a standoff between the president and the vice president of the country, a crisis which has received virtually no public attention at all. Uganda is actually doing a sterling job of trying to cope, but of course is completely overrun. And the circumstances of the refugees are dire. And then there's another major set of humanitarian emergencies in Central America, where rates of violence and drug and other gang-related activity have also reached epidemic proportions. A complex of different humanitarian emergencies, which is enormous. But of course, we've focused a lot of attention, rightly, on what's happening in the Mediterranean and in Syria.
The most harrowing element of the report to many people will be the sexual exploitation of children, with many children reportedly now selling their bodies to try and raise money to pay people smugglers. Was this the most shocking element of your study to you?
I think it was. We'd had an inkling, because it's an area we've worked on for many years. Our centre has been involved in issues of child migration for a long time. So we had a sense that there were severe risks to children, and it's been known for a long time that children suffer from all forms of exploitation en route, you know, not only sexual exploitation, but also labor exploitation, vulnerability to traffickers and so on. So that's been known and that's harrowing enough. But I think it's really recent, the discovery that this is now an endemic aspect of the problem, that children are really using what you might dreadfully call survival sex to manage, both in some cases just to manage their daily lives, but more importantly, to deal with what they see as a dead-end situation, being trapped in a place they don't want to be in and unable to really realize the point of their journey, which is to reach a place of safety and a place where they can support their families back home. One of the things that's particularly distressing is that these children, very young children, I mean, I think our report talks about an 11-year-old boy from Afghanistan, and he's not the only one, that these children have an enormous burden on their shoulders. Often they are, you know, they're the only member of the family who's managed to flee, and left behind is often a widowed mother with other younger children who are dependent on this child for their survival, for their well-being. And so this child feels the urgency of the need to move on and to do what he's meant to do. So I don't think we had really, until we did this study, I don't think we'd realized this. We had an inkling that things were amiss when we did an earlier report on the reception conditions in one of the Greek islands in Lesbos. But we did this study precisely because we thought that there was something else and worth going on. The only other thing I'd like to add is that it's not just the exploitative sex that we're worried about. We're also worried about just the endemic violence within the shelters where the children are staying. And we talk about that too. And that takes two forms. One form is the lack of adequate security. So as we say in the report, at 7 o'clock in the evening, the camp guards leave. And basically, these places, which are overcrowded and under-resourced, are unsupervised. Secondly, the lighting is poor. And thirdly, there are no locks or proper secure mechanisms at night to keep, for example, women or women and children safe. And so this exposes an already vulnerable community to risk. And secondly, and this is something which, of course, is much more widely known, because the circumstances of the refugee community are so harsh, parents themselves often, you know, take it out on their kids. So this is, in a way, a deeper problem of desperation and lack of coping. So I think our report mentions the case of a woman who received a negative decision on her asylum claim and came back, you know, to her kids and you know, lashed out at them. And it's an aspect of the despair and the lack of enough, you know, adequate support and facilities and alternatives that results in children actually bearing a huge amount of the brunt of the human suffering.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I was going to go on to ask you about, just is that obviously unaccompanied children are understandably identified as the most vulnerable group, but the psychological torment that family units experience, that parents experience, means that we must see all children as being incredibly vulnerable in this situation.
Yeah, I think we do feel that, and we're really horrified. I mean, I think, you know, some of us have been working on this subject for a very long time, but still, personally, I find our report extremely distressing. I mean, the notion that these young children are really being failed by us, are being failed by, you know, the community of humanity around them that's charged with responsibility. You know, what's happening in Syria is desperate, and we probably have not handled it at all well. But to feel that the human fallout is equally disastrous, and that the youngest and most vulnerable sufferers are kind of at the mercy of predators, is really horrifying. So our report takes pains not to sort of level too much blame on the Greek government, because, of course, the Greek government's in a very difficult situation, you know, having just emerged from the worst economic crisis they've faced in decades, to then find you have essentially a population of about 63 or 64,000 additional people trapped in your country who don't want to be there and who are your responsibility, people who have no wherewithals at all, is very hard. And I think the European Union and the broader community of, you know, international organizations takes a lot of the responsibility, should take a lot of the responsibility, and certainly if blame is to be accorded, should take some of the blame for this. I mean, relocations from Greece have been incredibly stagnant despite the promises. So people are just not moving on. Borders are closed, of course, so you need a smuggler if you're going to get out. And people feel hopeless, and the circumstances in the camps are utterly inadequate. And the last thing I'd say on this point is that if children really are going to be in a place like Greece, medium or long term, and all the signs are that they are, then we really need to think about, you know, the basic rights that all children have, including to proper education, not just some sort of stopgap couple of hours, you know, of some fully thought through syllabus in a camp, but actually they need to be mainstreamed into school. Because if they're going to be there for years, then there's no reason why these children shouldn't have the benefit of the same education as citizen children. And I think this is a broader issue in Turkey and in Jordan and Lebanon and other places where children are now, refugee children are now housed medium and long term. So we really need to rethink the way in which we administer humanitarian resources, because we're no longer in a situation where these populations are moving on fast. They are effectively settling, or certainly settling for years.
Your report highlights the current mechanisms and the gaps in those mechanisms, and has several recommendations. Now, what would you summarise or identify as being the most important recommendation to take away from this report?
I would say three things. Firstly, we need a coordinated set of responsible actors to be charged with responsibility for dealing with children. It needs to be a multi-agency responsibility headed by someone and some department who is in charge. So you need to bring together the social welfare organizations, education, health, immigration. You need to bring all these entities together, but there needs to be a proper organizational chain of command that at the moment is lacking, that you can't carry on with this anomic situation where this is not an issue sitting on anybody's desk. I would say that's the most urgent thing. Secondly, and this would be part of the charge of this entity, you need to carefully think about, first of all, securing the basic necessities. You need to take very seriously the decisions that children are making about their lives and address this, you know, real emergency. Children cannot carry on just selling sex openly in plain daylight in the Central Park in Athens. I mean, if this is a child protection emergency, I really don't know what is. So this is something that needs to be thought through. It means it's not an easy thing to fix. It means having a range of resources available, opportunities, thinking about a strategy for the future so that these children have some hope. So this is really urgent. So I would say that's the second thing. And thirdly, I think as an international community, we need to have a much more robust set of strategies for protecting children. So I think that children on the move or migrant children, as you may know, the UN has since September of 2016 been discussing the production of two new global compacts, one on migration and one on refugees. And I think that the issues relating to children, children's needs, children's rights and children's protection need to feature centrally in those policy documents. So at three levels, we need some institutional responsibility clearly defined and adequately resourced. We need some holistic intervention to address the actual emergency of sexual exploitation and violence. And we need a kind of institutional architecture internationally, which then, of course, applies domestically, which is much more capacious and much more responsive to current situations.
And just finally, I mean, there has been a feeling with aid groups in the EU for a few years now of how bad does it have to get before the international community really take further action. Is this the kind of crisis that we're only going to really appreciate the extent of with the value of hindsight?
I have a horrible feeling you might be right. I think we have a regrettable but consistent history of reacting in a knee-jerk fashion when the emergency is on our doorstep. And at the moment it's somewhat out of sight, we kind of heave a sigh of relief and move on. And because at the moment, the numbers of asylum seekers and distressed migrants more generally arriving in Western Europe have decreased, you know, we're really not giving the kind of necessary attention. And it's not just, of course, in Europe that we need attention. I mean, you need, obviously, first of all, to be thinking about the conflict and reducing the imperative to leave that so many people face. And we need to be thinking about what's happening in the surrounding areas, too. Situation in Turkey, of course, only makes this more complicated now. So I think it's not, I'm not for 1 minute suggesting this is the quick fix, But I think this is a real disaster, which, as you rightly say, with hindsight, we'll look back and feel quite ashamed of our inertia and our failure to protect some of the most vulnerable members of our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Jacqueline Baba, thank you so much for speaking to us today. It's a pleasure having you on World in Focus.
Thank you for speaking to me. Take care.
That was Professor Jacqueline Baba from Harvard University talking to me about their new report detailing a child protection emergency. This is Carolyn Scott for World in Focus.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
This is Radio Sputnik. Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, the US National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster met with Pakistan's Prime Minister and Army Chief this week on the importance of confronting terrorism. But we'll be taking a closer look at the alleged role of the Pakistani Secret Service in aiding and abetting terrorism in South Asia. That's in just a few moments.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
All right, we'll do one together. You ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the US National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, met with Pakistan's Prime Minister and Army Chief this week on the importance of confronting terrorism. But we'll be taking a closer look at the alleged role of the Pakistani Secret Service in aiding and abetting terrorism in South Asia. And animal lovers can be a strange bunch, but how far would you go to revive the life of a pigeon that suddenly dropped dead in a busy shopping centre? US National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster has said during a meeting with the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif this week that Pakistan must, quote, confront terrorism in all its forms. Both the Afghan and Indian governments have been requesting that the Trump administration put pressure on their mutual neighbour Pakistan to rein in the Taliban and other terrorist groups. Since 9/11, serious questions have been asked by journalists and scholars over the alleged connection between the Pakistani secret services and groups like the Afghan Taliban and the infamous Haqqani Network. For more on this, here's Matthew Aiton.
United States President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, met with Pakistan's Prime Minister and Army Chief on Monday to proclaim, quote, the need to confront terrorism in all of its forms. Mr. McMaster was on his first trip to South Asia as the Trump administration's national security advisor and praised the development of the country's democracy and economic growth. It remains unclear as to whether the Trump administration will take a tougher stance toward Pakistan, as has been requested of it by its allies Afghanistan and India. The Afghan government has, for a long time, accused Pakistan, in particular its inter-services intelligence agency, of providing weaponry, funding and training to Taliban fighters on Pakistan's side of the border. Pakistan denies the allegations, which have plagued its relations with Afghanistan and India for decades. However, there are independent reports that verify the Afghan government's claims. Harvard University South Asia analyst Matt Waldman has been quoted as saying that Pakistan's support for the Taliban goes far beyond just limited or occasional support. There are very significant levels of support being provided by the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. After Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's meeting with National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, Sharif's office released a statement saying that, quote, the Prime Minister conveyed Pakistan's readiness to work with the international community to explore ways in which the Afghan crisis can be resolved. But with the foreign policy priority of the Trump administration being the defeat of Daesh and Islamism, some are speculating that it may start to put more pressure on Pakistan to stem the flow of Taliban fighters and other insurgencies in neighbouring countries. Joining us to discuss this in further detail now is Dr. Ayesha Sadiqa, a research associate from the South Asia Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Dr. Sadiqa, thanks for joining us here on World in Focus. So, President Trump's National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, said during a visit to Pakistan this week that, quote, there is a need to confront terrorism in all of its forms. What has the U.S.'s counter-terrorism policy toward Pakistan looked like up until now?
Up till now, I think, and this has been the consistency, there has been that consistency in U.S. policy, is that a cooperation, certain kind of cooperation with Pakistan, pushing Pakistan to do more, yet not going beyond a certain pressure. So for a long time, what we've seen is through the decade since, through the decade of counterterrorism after 9/11, what we've seen is every government, every administration pushing Pakistan to do more. But, you know, ultimately, cajoling it, yet ultimately getting into a cooperation. The tone of, what has been said to Pakistan seems slightly different, but whether Pakistan, whether America really takes a U-turn, takes a different position, you know, it's a different matter. Every be Trump or Obama, every administration has told Pakistan to do more, and yet it has tolerated whatever Pakistan has done.
There are, of course, major reports and investigations that I'm sure you're aware of into the links between the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency and the Taliban in Afghanistan. Can you tell us a little bit more about those, please?
Well, you know, so far there is, I mean, I don't have any kind of information on what kind of, you know, what actions Afghanistan has taken, but Afghanistan has accused Pakistan for a very long time that it supports the Haqqani network. And Haqqani network is that part of the Taliban group which has created a lot of violence in Afghanistan. And it is a group which hurts America and Afghanistan as well. A lot of people in Pakistan also believe that Pakistan continues to support Haqqani network and that in the name of cleaning up terrorism, the last military operation is Zarb-e-Azam. It did clean up part of the territory, but it pushed a lot of these people into Afghanistan or continues to provide them support so that once America leaves Afghanistan, the Taliban will be there, can be used to, again, dominate Afghanistan. That's what Pakistan is accused of.
So surely if the Trump administration is serious about stemming terrorism in Pakistan and South Asia more generally, surely it needs to grapple with, needs to confront the issue of these reports that the Pakistani secret services are involved with groups like the Taliban. Do you see that happening at all?
See, it depends. Ultimately, what Trump will manage to do. Right now in Washington, there is a lot of confusion on what Trump really wants to do. I mean, this is an administration which is under a lot of pressure. Now, what he has done is, you know, throw one bomb on Afghanistan in the name of fighting Daesh. Now, whether it will hurt Daesh or not, we're not sure. The assessment that we have so far is very American. It doesn't come from an independent source. The same applies to Syria. So what he's done is there is an aerial bombardment, you know, tendency to do that. But is he going to put boots on ground? More boots on ground. It's an evolving policy, I would say. Trump seems to be sending this message that he's there, he's going to be tough. But what does this toughness actually translate into? That needs to be seen.
I've read reports recently that there is a burgeoning Daesh presence and support base in Pakistan. Is it possible that you could tell us a little bit more about that, please?
You know, I sometimes wonder, you know, how to dissect different groups. If you start looking at their ideology, Al-Qaeda ideology is similar to Daesh ideology. And what Daesh and Al-Qaeda are doing, are saying their ideology is very similar to Lashkar-e-Taiba. So ideologically, there is little difference. It's just a matter of tactics. Daesh has been there. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, recently there was this young girl from Sindh. Now, Sindh is a part of Pakistan which is known for its syncretic culture, which has been more tolerant, comparatively more tolerant than others. Yet, recently, and this is just a few days ago, a girl was caught who was trying to travel to Daesh and become a suicide bomber. Does it surprise us? No, because in the past couple of years, there have been at least 1,000 to 1,500 Pakistani men who have gone to Syria, who joined either Daesh or you know, Hezbollah. So, and these people, naturally, they travel back. You know, there's back and forth. So Daesh will be there. Al-Qaeda has been there for a longer time. And I do not see structurally there is a lot of difference between Al-Qaeda and Daesh, except, you know, the difference in the leadership. Another part of the problem is that the Pakistan-based groups continue to be there in Pakistan has been very reluctant in taking action against those groups. So in under the circumstances, I see Daesh threat to be there. people will join. People will cross over from one group to another.
And just finally, the Obama administration tended to shy away from the issue of Kashmir, which has acted, of course, as a sore on the face of relations between Pakistan and India. Do you think the Trump administration needs to play a more active role in conflict mitigation there? And if so, how?
See, firstly, the question is Kashmir the only source of the problem? And if Kashmir is resolved, will it kind of stop Pakistan from supporting one kind of militant or the other? I have a question in mark in my mind. But if, say, a major part of the problem is resolved by solving Kashmir, will the Trump administration be able to help? Again, I have my doubts. And partly because the thing is that the Trump administration is so much in trouble in its own home base. Nobody knows in Washington what does he mean, where is he going, what is coming next. So that's his internal instability is one major issue. But say, for example, they manage to get their act together and try to resolve it. The question is, will India be wanting to resolve that? Does America have enough clout to put pressure into Pakistan and bring them back, for example, the both countries, to a proposal that General Musharraf had, you know, had come up with in 2006-2007, which is that there should be autonomy, greater people-to-people movement, but consider the line of control as gradually turn it into an international boundary. That is probably the only resolution worth looking at. If you think that India is going to even look at, seriously think about UN resolution, solving the issue according to UN resolution, I don't think that there is any hope in that. But, you know, it's worth trying. Somebody should be able to negotiate, help the two states negotiate while they don't talk to each other about this issue. You know, it should be a welcome move.
Okay, Dr. Siddiqua, thank you very much for your time.
All right.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
And finally, Scotland is a country with its fair share of animal lovers, but one Glasgow shopper went above and beyond to help a pigeon that had suddenly dropped dead in a busy shopping street in the city. Unfazed, the woman picked up the lifeless bird and began giving it cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, blowing gently into the pigeon's beak and massaging its chest. Alas, the lady's new feathered friend didn't make it, its head flopping lifelessly to the side following the medical intervention. Another shopper later took to Twitter, where else, to inform the online community that she had later seen the unfortunate bird being eaten by a seagull. It's a dog-eat-dog, or should that be bird-eat-bird world out there. That's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Mark Hurst, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
By any means necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us, from mass incarceration.
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video, and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Every day we ask questions.
How is Facebook going to prevent suicides?
Well, do you see this as being a human rights violation?
Are the cows really stinking up the planet that much?
To move ideas forward.
A gravitational wave is a ripple in the fabric of space and time.
I don't think the launch of the satellite proves anything at all.
Where do good ideas come from? We connect with independent thinkers, hear their ideas, and create stimulating debates on real issues.
The Dow is in a correction. As I said, commodities across the globe are collapsing. Why is that the case? Because we are in a global recession.
That is set to change because Iran has approximately about 50 million barrels, which it had put in storage during the height of the sanctions regime, and that's ready to be released as soon as possible.
Where is the money?
The super rich individuals and the world's biggest companies are able to hide money in tax havens.
Is there a solution to the crisis?
No, because I don't think anything useful has come out of any of the policy reform discussions with respect to financial reform.
They give us answers we aren't always prepared for.
What are the chances that the report would make Israeli authorities to review their policies towards the Palestinians?
Oh, probably zero.
This recession will be even worse than it was in 2008.
But that would be the nasty way for it to happen, you know.
But because of Guantanamo, the U.S. is no longer taking so many prisoners. So instead of taking prisoners, they kill people.
A lot of people think that he's now unelectable and a bad leader.
Wow, that's just so much information to take in.
Pay attention, there'll be a test on this later.
Taking notes.
Welcome to the show.
Wow.
This is crazy. We're definitely talking sci-fi over here. From 20 years ago, people would never have believed this. Crazy times we're living in.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around this story. This is a fantastic story.
Yes, it is a fantastic story, and it's a worldwide problem.
Welcome to the party.